are listening to a message from Stonegate Church. For more information about Stonegate and additional audio resources, please visit stonegate.church.
All right, man, that was wonderful.
Great job, bro.
You are so smart. You kind of flew through that definition of progressive Christianity. Can you tell us one more time, what are we talking about tonight? What is progressive Christianity?
What is happening, Ryan? I'm so scared.
Yeah, that's a good question. Let me just read it again for us so that can give us a little bit of context for what I'm sharing. So progressive Christianity is a movement that seeks to make the Christian faith more inclusive and culturally relevant, but often does so by rejecting or redefining core biblical truths, lowering the authority of Scripture, and softening the gospel into something that feels good but lacks saving power.
Awesome.
So, as I said before, too, the difficult part about it is you're not necessarily dealing with something that's highly organized, but it's a little bit more of a mood, a vibe, and a movement that encapsulates a number of different streams of theology and even social engagement and practice. But what it shares in common is how do we change to match the mood and the expectations of culture and allow that to be in the driver's seat of defining our theology.
So many people loved your definition that they were just asking for you to say it again. So we're going to send that out to you guys in the notes afterwards. But Ryan, you really are one of the best thinkers that I've heard of talk on this particular thing. But there's something I wanted to dig in just a little bit deeper. You know, every cultural movement that's kind of an alternative from evangelical Christianity has its source in the church. So I just wanted to kick off by asking, how have we as Christians kind of paved the way for the progressive Christianity and making it attractive for other people?
Yeah, I think a couple things. I touched on a little bit. One was even just fear. So fear can drive us very much into a place of a little bit like the business mindset. America is a very business-driven place. We're entrepreneurial. We start stuff. And businesses need to be responsive to their market. If you don't, you're like Kodak. You go out of business. You weren't responsive to the market. And churches sometimes have swallowed that mindset of, if we don't adapt, if we don't adjust, if we don't accommodate, we're going to die. So they, as I said, like there was a little bit of a bait and switch there of like, I think Satan is baiting the hook of going, make these changes, and once again, the world will affirm you. Well, the world's never affirmed the gospel of Jesus. You know, the gospel has always been somewhat offensive throughout all of church history. So that's number one. And then number two, and I'll just own it, I'm right in this boat as well. There is strong individualism that just pervades the church, but even us as Christians. And this feeds into and is fueled by that desire for individualism. So sometimes it's hard for us to see church as a family and for us to see ourselves collectively and as the people of God. And we live in a very individualistic, consumer-based culture, which is teaching us and promoting to us that really you exist to make your own dreams come true rather than to live in the story of God. So those are very different narratives of individualism. I'm here to self-actualize and make my own dreams come true and fulfill my own purpose in life versus I exist for God's pleasure to glorify God and I'm living in his story.
Yeah, Disneyland Christianity. Love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
You love that?
I just the mind that thought I thought about Mickey Mouse just, Jesus
it's on
or
record,
something.
Yeah, recording.
That's right. Don't love it, by the way, for the record. But this is a question. I'm going to kick this out there for both of you guys. So speaking about just knowing the market a little bit, right? So one of the biggest conversations that have been out there really since COVID and before was this whole social injustice issue, right? So people are rightly seeing that there are some systemic injustices, and yet people aren't sure how to address those without falling into progressive Christianity. So how would you tell us with the social justice issue, a lot of people are leaving evangelicalism because there's not been a good answer for this. How would you coach people how to deal with that?
Well, I don't see Orthodox Christianity as in tension at all with caring about issues of justice in society. I mean, you can't read the New Testament or the Old Testament for that matter and not go, God's heart is for the orphan, the widow, the marginalized. I mean, just over and over and over. So I think it's a strange thing that evangelicalism would get stamped as like anti that when it's like, man, have you read the Bible? It's like a big theme. I just think that Orthodox Christianity refuses to put the cart before the horse. You know, it's not. It is not so much that morality is our religion, but our religion begets our morality. You know, and I think that's where progressive Christianity sort of twists it. They sort of put the cart before the horse, and they say, no, the whole thing is actually about doing good in culture. And it's like, well, doing good in culture is a fruit of my collision with the living Jesus. But we need to collide with the living Jesus through the power of the gospel first before that takes place. And, you know, perhaps it's the emphasis on the gospel that some people hear and they go, oh, so you don't care about what's going on out there on the streets. It's like, no, I super care. I just think the solution begins with the gospel. It doesn't begin with handouts, you know, to the poor. That comes second. Let's serve the poor after the gospel comes, and in tandem with, and when you abandon the gospel as the centerpiece of Christianity is not doing good things in culture. That is the fruit of Christianity. The centerpiece of Christianity is the exalted Christ, and so we have to major on that. And sometimes I think that can be heard and misread as not caring about that. But to be fair, sometimes evangelical churches have got that wrong. So, and I think there are some bad apples that have so focused on that that they have forgotten, no, there is a world around you. I just don't think that's the major.
Yeah, I know we have a lot of questions, so I'll try to be brief on this. These are really complicated conversations inside of this, but I mentioned before one of the things that progressive Christianity will do is it'll redefine terms, so you constantly have to go back and say, is this term being defined now by some other ideology or cultural institution or cultural zeitgeist or feeling or impression, or is it being defined biblically? So we are people who love justice, but I do want to always make a case, let's define justice biblically. And justice biblically is always actually going to first start first and foremost with the problem is not out there. As I said before, the problem can be to externalize sin, very much so. Liberation theology, which is an offshoot of progressive Christianity, very much wanted to make the primary consideration preoccupation of Christians to look at things from an economic lens solely or only, so much so that you diminish or almost forget the work of Jesus Christ, that God saves sinners. And I think you, when you do that, you are throwing the baby out with the bathwater. You're not getting justice because you don't even have a concept or grounds for justice anymore. You throw out God and you really are left with survival of the fittest might makes right. That's your best operating frame for how cultures and societies ought to operate and function and work. So I would just say this, there are all sorts of great resources. D.A. Carson's wrote a book called Christ and Culture Revisited. I think gets into this. There's all sorts of good books on the topic of justice that I would recommend. But what I would say is this is still just that conversation of like, where are you seeing the animating problem? Is the problem internally that you and I have moved in moral rebellion against a holy God, a God of the universe? Because we're reconciled to him, that vertical reconciliation, it should have horizontal reconciliation implications, but that's an implication. It's not the heartbeat or the sole emphasis of the gospel itself.
That's so good. Just not confusing the fruit with the root. Bad things happen when that happens.
It does, yeah. And I think that's where you are. You're getting a shift in emphasis, which is another way to accommodate.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about accommodation, because LGBTQ issue is another big question when it comes to progressive Christianity. So you just said, in Christianity, we really want to be firm on the truth without accommodating. Well, how would you, if you guys were dealing with an LGBTQ friend or a Christian who was thinking about how to be more inclusive and accommodating to their LGBTQ friends, what kind of encouragement would you give? How can they stand on truth and still be loving? How can they accommodate without affirming? I mean, there's all these kinds of questions wrapped up in that.
Yeah, I'll offer a few. Jimmy's probably got great thoughts on this too. I just want to say I'm in the arena on this topic. So this is part of my life. You know, pastoring in Seattle for a number of years, this was a very common conversation or situation for me to find myself in. And it's still part of my life as friends and family that I know I'm having these conversations with, and they're live. I think for us as Christians, the very first thing that's just returning to this idea that we believe sin is real is I'm going to put myself in the boat with them. You know, one of the things I do want to acknowledge, sometimes we have found a way to segregate or single out certain sins and to demonize them. So in these conversations, I think one of the first things we need to acknowledge that there's not a person who's walked into this room tonight whose sexuality isn't somewhat broken, that doesn't need redemption. And when we begin to think that the redemption of certain sexual sins look different than the redemption of other sexual sins, you find yourself creating unnecessary barriers and hostility. So I think we're reminding, we're saying the same source that's redeeming my broken sexuality and my broken sexual life is also at work in someone who's part of the LGBT world.
So good. Yeah. Would you add anything to that, Jim?
No, I was going to say something similar to that. You know, Christopher Yuan has a book called Holy Sexuality, and I think the title of it he is his thesis. You know, and this is what I say to folks that I've engaged with in the LGBTQ community and folks who are sympathetic to that worldview is, you know, the opposite of, this is Christopher, not me, but the opposite of homosexuality is not heterosexuality. The opposite of homosexuality is holiness.
Mm, that's good. And
heterosexuality is not intrinsically righteous. Right. Righteous, holy heterosexuality is, right? But we are all aiming for holiness. We're not aiming for just... what partner are you attracted to? That's not the aim. The aim is submitting all of my sexual desires to the will of Christ.
Yeah.
And I think when it's that, in a lot of ways, is a way to sort of bring your arms around all of us and go, hey, it's not just you out there with your weird sexual ethic and me with my normal one. It's like, no, we're all, to your point, we're all broken. We all need holiness, and only Christ can provide that.
That's right. I would just recommend on top of that, be sure that you're clear on the relationship between love and affirmation. Love and affirmation are not the same thing, and nor should they be. If my son wants to jump off the top of our staircase because he thinks he's Superman, nothing about me would affirm that's a good idea. If I love him, right? So loving him would mean in that moment not affirming that his decision is right. And I think if you're going to make a difference in progressive Christianity is all about love equals affirmation. We're going to accommodate, it's Burger King Christianity, right? You're the king, right? Have it your way. We actually need to be clear that the gospel is most loving because it doesn't give us our way. That it's actually bad news when we have it our way. So be sure you're clear on that. Now, let's just practice here just a little bit. So let's just say that we're not on stage. We're sitting here on this coffee shop pub table. And I tell you guys, I'm really thinking about going progressive. This Jesus is a little too narrow-minded. The one that I grew up with, my church stinks. I kind of hate all the evangelicals that I'm seeing, just their attitudes and what they're posting on Facebook. Where would you guys begin to have that conversation with me? Like, if you just heard that from a friend, where would you begin to minister to me as someone thinking about going progressive?
I probably would first ask, where did you find this Jesus, the one you're after? Because for me, so many of these conversations come back to our sources of truth, you know, because your answer would have to be ultimately the one I made up. Mm. You probably would put it in more charming terms that made yourself look better, but you, at the end of the day, we're appealing to something to say, I'm following that. And to the person who says, I prefer this Jesus, not that one. I just get really curious about, well, where did that guy come from?
Right.
And it ultimately, if it just came from your mind, is that a Jesus you want to stake your life on? Hmm. You know, the Bible being our foundation of authority is in so many conversations I've had with progressive Christians. It seems to always come back to this: what is your truth source? Hmm. I would want to sort of put that pebble in their shoe of like, you are autonomous, you can do whatever you want,
right.
But do you want to stake your eternity on a guy that you cooked up in your brain? Is that how you want to do it? Because that's the only other alternative. There's no other Jesus but the one that's revealed.
This sounds so like the pastor thing you're supposed to say, but it changed my life when I was first becoming a Christian. Is I just read the Gospels a lot. Like, I wanted to hear from Jesus. I wanted to see Jesus. And Jesus is, surprisingly, I find even a lot of Christians don't actually look and listen to Jesus a lot. I mean, he's radically different than most of the portrayals and connotations and perceptions most of us have in our minds. And here's another thing, too. Tim Keller said this years ago. He's like, man, the gospel or Jesus is always going to offend cultures at different points. And sometimes you never even realize that. Like, he always used this example. If you went to the Middle East and you went over there and explained to them the sexual ethic of the Bible, they're largely going to kind of get on board with that. They're going to be like, yeah, that sounds about right. That's a good sexual ethic. They're going to be okay. That's not the part they're going to be offended by. If you're in Manhattan, that's the part they're offended by. Mm. But what they would be offended by is the grace and mercy part. Mm. They'd be offended by like, wait, your God humbled himself and he came down to this earth and he was a marginalized guy and he died a humiliating death. I can't accept that. I can't tolerate that. But if you go to America, we can tolerate that. We love grace and mercy. So what you're seeing is the gospel always offends. So sometimes you have to ask yourself, is this my cultural conditioning? Because the gospel offends every culture, but it also includes every person if we will surrender and submit to the real Jesus.
Yeah. Now, let's just press in just a little bit further there, because in my experience with progressive Christianity, the onus, the reason for changing from evangelicalism to progressive Christianity typically has been because people hate the church. It's judging the bridegroom by looking at his imperfect bride. So can we back up just a moment? What if you find, like, there's young people in the room, there's students who are watching and they're looking, I don't want to become like a curmudgeon, you know, I don't want to be grumpy old people that are always get off my lawn and, you know, hitting people with their Bible. Like, they don't want to become that way. What would you say to someone who's thinking about making that shift, not because of theological reasons, but because they can't stand what they see around them in church?
Well, I would sympathize with that a lot, and I've heard that a lot. And I think those are largely legitimate grievances. I mean, we all have friends and family who have, and maybe we are the person who it's like, man, I have a hard time embracing Jesus because that pastor wounded me. Those Christian friends were spiteful or mean or unkind, or that, you know. So that sort of hypocrisy it's a real thing. Yeah. It is a blight on the gospel. It's an offense to Christ. So I'd probably just start by sympathizing with a lot of that. And then I would probably, you know, you can't, there's no magic words that I could say to change that person's perspective. But I would feel really inclined to be a really great friend to them. Yeah. On the other side of that, and hope that the Holy Spirit would use my influence as a Jesus lover to go, hey, here's one guy who's not like that. Can we agree that doesn't, yeah, that's not always going to happen, you know? Yeah. So I would hope that, like, living incarnationally with them, kindly, humble, would be a force for change, yeah, for them.
These questions are always so hard to ask or answer without understanding a lot more about where it's coming from. Because let me just say a few things. I actually have, like, and it's served me really well from sometimes being disappointed or hurt. I just have, like, a biblical and I would say realistic view of people at times. And I'm like, they're going to hurt you. You will be disappointed. You will be let down. Jesus was betrayed. Jesus was abandoned, sometimes even by those closest to him. And I've had all of those kind of moments happen to me inside of the church. I've had all those and just felt like that same sense of like, man, is this really what the church is supposed to look like? And I've had all the moments of people surrounding me at some of my lowest moments, people encouraging me when I needed kindness, people picking me up when I couldn't pick myself up, laughter that I would have missed out on, basically a family. You know, like, sometimes even with your family, you have to ask yourself, is my expectations of everyone too high? Or am I actually just acknowledging, yeah, the reason you're at church is because you, the entry gate into the door in some ways is to say, I'm messed up.
Yeah,
I'm broken. Now, does that excuse it? Should you continue on it? No, I'm not saying that. That's why I'm saying this is hard to answer without knowing the particular situation. But one of the best things we can do if we really are going to be family and the people of God, we have really got to be less offendable. You know, in some of those moments, just realize sometimes people are going to hurt you. Sometimes it's going to be tough. Sometimes they're going to let you down. But you've got to, like, have some gospel resiliency, mm-hmm, and just faith, hope, and love that believes all things, endures all things, bears all things. in some of those moments too. So I would say sometimes I think our expectations might be a little too high when it comes to like the church always getting it right. It's like, no, every single one of us in this room, like we're messed up.
Yeah.
So, and as I said, that's me not knowing the full context in which that question's coming from.
Totally. I think we expect the bride to be perfect, and we've missed the point that the bride is being perfected, not perfect. The bridegroom's perfect. And so I often like to point people to the fact you've mistook the bride for the bridegroom. The bridegroom's perfect. He's great. And I think in that we got to be self-critical and allow ourselves to be able to say, and not so defensive.
Yeah, and here, as I'd say too, I'm getting to my mid-40s, so I'm not that old, but I'm feeling some of those kind of older thoughts and just even opinions at times. But I remember part of my jadedness that I mentioned when I was 22, reading Brian McLaren and thinking about progressive theology, some of my own story, is I was disappointed in the church. I was like, man, they should be doing more. We should be taking over the world. We should be, you know, eliminating poverty. Like, I had so much idealism, and that's a beautiful thing. I love the zeal and the energy of folks that are young. You can change the world. But the older I'm getting, sometimes my ambitions are getting a little bit more modest, where I just want to make it to the end faithful, where I love my wife, where I love my family, where I'm a faithful pastor, where I care for people, where I'm present. Like, sometimes that's also the case too. Like, you just have to ask yourself, are my expectations, even of what the church is going to do in one generation or moment, are they realistic?
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Let's ask another one here. So when it comes to like what books help shape this talk, when you're thinking about progressive Christianity, what would you recommend for people here to kind of further gain knowledge on how to minister to people in progressive Christianity?
Yeah. Oh gosh, book recommendations. I always got a lot of those.
Buckle your seatbelts. Ryan Kearns, everybody.
Ryan, try to keep it down to 45 seconds if you don't mind. Oh, so.
Well, a couple books that I think are really helpful on this topic. One, there's a book called Truth Decay by Doug Groteis, which is really good. I don't know if it's still in print. Well, it's probably on Amazon for sure for like 99 cents. That's a great book. That's going to really walk you through postmodernism, relativism, some cultural trends and subjectivism, all those isms that we love. So that's a really good book that you can glom onto. I would say there's another book called Exploring Christian Denominations, which is really helpful by, I think it's by a guy named David Bushart. And he just gives you at least a survey understanding of most of the mainline traditions and denominations, some of their core beliefs, ideas, and trends over the last 100 years or so. So that's another really helpful book on this topic. And then last one, I would say that's particularly helpful on this is going to be some books like Reinhold Niebuhr. He wrote a book called Christ and Culture, which is just going to tell you some of the ways that Christians have positioned and postured. It goes back even to the social justice conversation of how has the church, all the way from like, let's withdraw the monastic movement, yeah, to let's socially engaged and have a social gospel emphasis, and that spectrum along the way. As I said, we're not the first ones to wrestle with any of these questions. So the more we can lean on other Christians who have asked these questions, it's helpful for us.
I would also recommend, if you've got the resiliency for it, to actually read progressive literature. One of my professors said it great. He said, you know, the first courtesy we owe anybody we're going to disagree with is to understand the position and understand it so well we could sympathize with it. Hmm. And so I found reading sort of the an opponent's view has been really helpful to me. A couple maybe good starters for you. And again, you kind of have to know the condition of your own heart and mind to know, like, can I jump into this without really being, you know, swayed? But Richard Rohr's The Universal Christ, it's not a very big read, but it will expose you to a very popular, he's got a voice into so many of the loudest pop culture, progressive, pseudo-Christian voices out there on the internet and writ large. So The Universal Christ, and Rob Bell came out with a bit of a sleeper book after like he sort of summited on his descent. He wrote a book called What is the Bible? Which is, again, a great sort of primer on how that camp is going to see the Christian scriptures. So those could be really great.
Yeah, the closest I found too, that's such a good suggestion, Jimmy. I'm glad you brought that up, is Brian McLaren did write a book called Generous Orthodoxy, which is the closest I've found to like a systematic theology for progressive theology. Mm. So if you're looking and saying, what do they believe? Or as I said, it's going to feel squishy and they're going to dance a little bit. But he's a good writer, so it's also going to feel persuasive even at times. But depending on, but if you want to go to the source material, Generous Orthodoxy by Brian McLaren is another one that I referenced a few times in some of my thoughts.
Yeah, a lot of the emergent church stuff that came out from like the Velvet Elvis or different things like that.
Love Wins.
Yeah, yep. All yep. That. That kind of gives you some of the seeds that's kind of been put there. There is a voice out there, Alicia Childers. She's got a book called Another Gospel? She's a former Zoe girl, so I'm sure.
How'd you point to me?
I don't know. Am I just think Zoe girl. And
you know
I'm
how
like,
you were a Zoe girl. You know, she was a Zoe girl. It's
Jimmy
crazy.
Used to be a touring artist, so I was just like, okay, whatever. Maybe you knew him. I don't know. You and you two were on stage together and all that. But anyway. She's become a great voice for that. There are a couple questions in here that I want to deal with before we end. There's a couple questions on the institutionalized church. There's just some things about, but what about if the church becomes institutionalized or the institution of the church? The reason why I think it's important to ask is because you mentioned about the historical faith of the church. So we live in an age, it feels like there is a growing discontent with an institutional church. And that seems to be some of the beginning stages of, well, I'm going to go the exact opposite way, where it's not so institutional, kind of decentralized. Why is an institutional church good? Why is the church being an institution a good thing?
I've got a lot of thoughts. Okay, I'll just start with this. Another trend culturally, so this goes back to Watergate. So Watergate was a seminal moment in the American psyche and the cultural reality we find ourselves in. It was the first time you can look at polls and statistics where trust in institutions began to crater, and it's never really recovered for Americans. So we've become much more suspicious and skeptical of institutions, starting with Watergate, and a number of those moments. And I don't think COVID helped any of that. In fact, we now actually have trouble where people believe in almost anything. We find ourselves more paranoid and sometimes suspicious and doubtful of almost anything that feels institutional. We think there's always something more behind the curtain. So this is also a cultural theme that's going on. So part of it's that. We've become very anti-institutional in general. Now, I think some of that is reactive, because here's what I'd say. Institutions are neutral. They can be good or bad. I think they can be redeemed. In fact, here's some institutions that are biblical. Family, marriage, those are institutions given to us by God. Can marriage be good? Yes. Can it be hard and bad at times? Yes. But you don't get rid of the institution of family, do you? In fact, churches, we want to be pro-family. We want to be pro-marriage. We think those are sacred institutions that are worth redeeming. Why? Because institutions are often very enduring, and they're hardy, and they're resilient, and they can make it through generational upheaval. So sometimes when you toss out an institution, you're also risking your ability to send faithful deposits into future generations. So you have to ask yourself those questions. Like, there are benefits sometimes to saying, I want something to be very anti-institutional, and I just want it to be movement-based. But there's also risks to that. So here's what a place like Stonegate can do. If by God's grace, if we're a accountable, transparent, humble, godly, well-ordered institution, we have an opportunity to make a faithful gospel contribution for generations. I don't know about you, but that fires me up when I think about that. That outlives my living room or your living room. And I'm not knocking churches that have gone much more relational and small. In fact, there are advantages to that. But the plus side sometimes of a larger church or one that can be institutionalized is you do get to endure. Now, can you go sideways? Can you drift? Absolutely. But I don't think that makes institutions inherently bad. I just think that means they need to be submitted to the Lord Jesus.
Yeah. In fact, it doesn't take long for somebody who leaves the institution to make an institution of their own. You know, I've known so many people who have left mega churches or left churches because, it's become so institutionalized and it's drifting, and they go off and start their own thing, and 10 years later, it's drifted, and it's institutionalized. So you really can't escape institution. There's only, like you said, it's kind of neutral. It can either go good or bad. So if you want to throw out the institution, you're going to be running from that for the rest of your life.
Yeah, and we actually love a lot of institutions. I mean, universities are institutions. And I'm glad universities, for the most part, some universities more than others, I'm glad they endure. I'm glad they go from generation to generation. I'm glad they're there to raise up the next generation. And you want those to exist. So I think the question isn't, is institutions good or bad? Is it a good institution is really the question.
Yeah. Well, that's so helpful. I just think one more time, just for the guy in the back, why is an exclusive Jesus who doesn't change, who cannot be really morphed into our cultural moment in a way that we want, you know, he's not Plato Jesus. Why is that good news for people? Why is a Jesus who just kind of comes into the room as he is and just says, here I am? Why is that good news for the lost person? That question makes sense.
The silence was not us.
Yeah, I was like, oh man, this is my first time in seeing. Yeah. This is my first and last time in seeing. So here we go. Yeah.
Well, that Jesus is the only Jesus that can save. Any Jesus we make up has no power to save. I mean, this is why any cults or anything like this that apes Christianity and borrows, you know, the names of, you know, Christ or salvation or grace or whatever, but they reinterpret the meaning. There's no power in it. That's a God to suit themselves. Ryan talked about it in his message. And so, I mean, like, fundamentally, we're just saying, I just want to interact with the only one who has the power to redeem me from hell and bring me into the kingdom of his Father. Fundamentally, I can only know that guy if he reveals himself to me, and he has, and it's been captured in words, and we know those words. And so the Jesus of Scripture is the only Jesus with the authority to do anything meaningful in my life, including what so many of us long for, which is to change culture and redeem and help and heal.
Yeah.
So,
that's so great.
This is a Christological conversation that's super important for us to realize. The question almost presupposes that Jesus isn't an actual person. You know, if he is an actual person, if he's the God-man, there is only one way to know him, just like there's only one way to know Jimmy. I mean, he's an actual person. So he's here, just like there's only one way to know. I mean, that is by its definition, if you're to know a person, it's exclusive. Yeah. And they get to set the terms and they get to set the rights of what it looks like to engage with them, especially if they're God.
Yeah.
So it's reminding ourselves that we're not talking about a force, once again, or an animating energy. We're talking about God who came and took on human flesh and is now the God-man. And he says, this is the way to know me. That's not exclusive. That's just personal.
Yeah.
I mean, if I want to know Jesus, I have to come to Jesus on his terms, not on mine.
Yeah. We want the God who is, and we need people to see the God who is, not the people we want him to be, right? Because that's the way they're going to get healing. Tonight, our encouragement to you, as you're engaging with progressive Christians, as you're seeing this phenomenon grow in our nation, this is really where a lot of people are going. I mean, it's either New Age spiritualism, which is kind of open throttle, believe what you want, it all kind of gets you the same place, to progressive Christianity, which is a little narrower, still keeps the name Jesus, or they're going full-fledged secularism. Those are the three areas, but most of them are going into this progressive Christianity route because it fits well. And one of the things we can tell you is Jesus doesn't change. Jesus doesn't change. He doesn't change who he is. He's the most sincere, authentic being in existence. And to be authentic means he doesn't change because you don't like aspects about him. He is who he is. He is the God who says, I am who I am. And we want to be Christians who proclaim that God, because that's the God who heals. Guys, we love you. We hope to see you at the next Equip Night, November 2nd. Sign up for John Piper Night, special celebration. It's a Texas holiday now. John Piper Night, October 17th, 18th, and 19th. So be sure and register for that. We'll see you next time. Thanks for coming.